We didn't get all the way through the st through storage last time, so we'll talk about that.
Okay, maybe you should grab a few bandages before we start, after what happened last time we recorded.
Fine. Better safe than sorry. Be right back.
Someone's calling. Hello?
Hello, Mr. DeBoer?
It's De Beer, actually.
I'm Steven Mnuchin, Secretary of Treasury, Master Investor, Economics Expert, and Crusader against the corporate income tax.
Yes, Mr. Mnuchin, we actually talked on the phone just a few weeks
I'm
ago.
calling because I heard someone listening to your podcast in front of a Starbucks, and you were talking about communism.
Mr. Mnuchin, we literally just talked about this. The episode wasn't about
You
communism at
know
all. It
communism
was.
doesn't work, right?
Mr. Mnuchin,
The
can you
problem
even
is
hear
you
me?
can't have communism without a totalitarian
I
government,
don't think you
okay?
can hear me.
Nobody will willingly share their money or car or house or wife
Should I
with
just
you.
hang up?
In fact, usually I pay to share someone's wife with them, so doing it for free is just out of the question.
Mean, it's great to have someone powerful talking to us, but if you can't even hear me, I don't
Yes,
see the
PJ,
point.
I can hear you. Now stop interrupting me. You asked me a question. Can I answer it?
I haven't even asked you any
What you
questions.
really need to be like is Econ Talk or Alpha Chat. Now, those are great podcasts. They don't have any frivolous attempts at humor. Their hosts are adults and therefore mature, and they have actual qualifications to speak about the topics they cover. And they definitely don't talk about weird stuff like sharing your wife with society.
We definitely have not talked about sharing our wives. Are you sure you listen to our podcast? It's called Neighbor Science. I'm not entirely sure what you're thinking of.
Yes, I'm sure. You said prices aren't really supply and demand. Capitalism is evil, blah blah blah. Therefore, we should share our wives with everyone. I follow the logic, but I disagree with the premises. Anyway, instead of having the government tax everything I own to give it to people who don't work for it, we need to do exactly the opposite. We need to lower corporate income taxes, which will bring jobs back from overseas for all the lazy people whose only employment is sticking out their hand for the government to give them food and shelter. Ever since Obama became president, it's always tax this, regulate this. Poor people are dying. It's disgusting.
I give
Poor
up.
people are dying because they don't work hard enough. And now they want to talk about communism? Why don't you move to the Soviet Union if you think communism is so great? Oh wait, you can't, because communism doesn't work.
I can't do this anymore. Steve Mnuchin, everybody.
Okay, so if we're going to be talking about how to compare fossil fuels versus nuclear versus renewables, then I think, and honestly, I think we can toss fossil fuels out the window. I know that they're still going to be around for a while, but
Yeah, everyone knows they're bad.
everyone knows they're bad, and the major players around the world are, most of them, except for the US, are starting to phase things out. So, even if Daddy Trump wants to keep plugging fossil fuels, he's not going to be in office forever. And things do actually, and like everything I've been reading says that at the local level, cities are busy making plans to move ahead to achieve the Paris Agreement targets and so on and so forth, regardless of whether or not Trump wants to pull out. So I don't think fossil fuels are going to play the major part that they would like to. They are going to obviously still be around for a while, but because I think that they're going to be phased out, I think, yeah, what we're left discussing is nuclear versus renewables. And if we're going to look at these, then we have to look at them kind of critically. As I've already said, I'm not the biggest fan of nuclear energy for various reasons, and I am a big fan of renewables. But I'm still on the fence when it comes to nuclear because I do see a lot of potential.
Yeah, I'm open
So
to it
it.
because of that 80% thing, like the 80% of fossil fuels have to stay in the ground thing. Like, all right,
Yeah.
well, you know, if it's that bad, then Maybe we should try it.
and let's face it, if we're going to be building up a decent, solid platform of energy that allows developing nations to continue developing, we can't throw out a technology like nuclear just out of principle.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of those things will replace a coal plant for like 30 years. That's pretty good.
Indeed. Yeah, look, I actually asked someone the other day, I asked about a comparison of renewables and nuclear energy, and okay, someone responded to me without even touching on renewables at all. They basically just gave me a very quick, short list of why they don't support nuclear technology. So I think I just quickly want to run through that.
Okay.
In quick point form, they said it was too expensive to build, and although nuclear plants, once they are built, they are relatively inexpensive to maintain. You know, to run on a daily basis, it doesn't take that much. They are, unfortunately, really ridiculously expensive to build.
Right.
They are also ridiculously expensive to decommission. I mean, it's one of those things where a country literally has to think way into the future, because the lifespan of a nuclear power plant is around 5 decades. And after those 5 decades, you have to be very careful about decommissioning everything properly. They then also mentioned that there's too long a lead time to build. Now, I'm not 100%
sure. Yeah, it takes like 10
years. So the entire nuclear facility, I think you're looking at about a century with all the lead time to build, then the build time, then the run time, and then the decommission time. You're looking at about a century's worth of investment that has to go into this. And and for the level of energy that you're getting out of it, and the fact that it relies on grid storage, it does make it something that isn't necessarily as appealing,
like, yeah,
as
yeah,
putting as putting solar panels on a roof, you
right
know?
Yeah, but then on the other hand, that okay, all that does kind of back up the private sector can't do it, so the government has to, kind of thing. I don't know, I think like if a federal government just kind of contracted people to build it, but like they financed the project and everything, I think it could work out, you know.
Definitely, it can work out, but then unfortunately we're stuck with this whole problem of authoritarianism and corruption. And,
well, we get that with companies too.
Oh, no, of course. I'm just thinking in terms of South Africa and the nuclear deal that they've been pushing with Russia.
Okay.
Where, in essence, yes, there will be energy provided in 20 or 30 years once those plants are up and running.
Most of the time, between the rolling blackouts.
Yeah, between the rolling blackouts. But then the problem is that the only benefit to South Africa is that there will be electricity. There's no jobs being created for South Africans. There's no income being generated for South Africans. The income is all being used to repay loans and everything that is international. There's no solid money coming in. It's
like a windfall to Russia, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to question whether or not federal governments are able to run this in such a way that it benefits climate in the long run, and it benefits nations in the long run, and so on. There has to be another way. Is it not possible for communities to crowdsource these kinds of things? And obviously, we are talking about billion-dollar projects. I'm not so sure that there aren't ways around this using credit unions and that kind of stuff.
It could be that we need to kind of get control of a government that can create its own money and use that to finance the project, or create endogenous money from, I don't know, do credit unions have the power to, like, loan money the way that banks do, where they just kind of create a deposit entry without needing any, like, actual money?
Well, I think that's one of the differences between commercial banks and credit unions is that there is no fractional reserve system. You know, they don't just generate money out of thin air. Everything that they run on is community assets. It's community capital.
Maybe they should generate money out of thin air.
Yeah, you know.
Then we could do these billion-dollar projects.
Yeah. Okay. Before we get sidetracked, there's one more big problem that we have to discuss about nuclear, and that is that people aren't investing in nuclear because they still have problems with the waste, despite all the promises that have been made about new technologies, about new different ways to deal with the nuclear waste. At the end of the day, nuclear waste is still being created by right. plants that were built as little as a decade ago, and they will continue to produce nuclear waste for another 40 years.
So there was this really good Quora answer about how viable nuclear adoption is. And so the answer that I'm talking about basically compared it to renewable energy, as Peter alluded to earlier. And the main points are renewables are a lot easier to build. They don't take 10 years, and they don't take like $1 billion of funding. You don't have to decommission them, really. And, you know, they're just like a smaller project overall. You can make them in a factory and then assemble them on site. Second, they require skilled trade jobs rather than like a nuclear scientist, which is a really extremely specialized discipline that requires higher education, probably maybe a PhD, I don't even know. And you know that science is not applicable like anywhere else really. So you have to be really dedicated to study it, and then you're kind of stuck in that job. But you know, putting together windmills and solar panels, that's like a, you know, it's a skilled trade job, so you don't even need higher education for it really. You just need training. And so, you know, we could create a lot of working class jobs using renewables.
I remember last year, one of the guys that I follow on Facebook posted a link about how at the moment solar and wind, basically the renewable sector, has nearly double the amount of jobs as fossil fuels. So if you want to employ a nation, go renewable.
Yeah. Yeah, I one of my favorite pictures ever, I don't know if I still have it on my computer, is this worker who's, you know, he's got a little like carabiner and a harness and everything, and he's like strapped to the top of a windmill, and he's like working on it. And that, like, it's this really cool view, like you can see for like dozens of miles. Mm. And I, like, every time I look at that, I'm just like, man, that looks fucking awesome. I wish I could get a job like that. That'd be cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So the next point is that they're easier to finance. You know, renewables are pretty risk-free. They're much smaller purchases on a smaller time scale. They pay themselves back faster, especially because they don't take 10 years to build. You know, I think solar panels repay themselves in like one to 3 years. Pretty good. They're less risky. But the risk of nuclear power is a little bit colored by our kind of emotional response and how high profile any kind of nuclear problem is. You know, the Fukushima thing was covered for like months, and people, you know, there's like all these conspiracy theories about it, of course. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, I love the Fukushima conspiracy theories.
Yeah, there's no conspiracy theories about like, oh, this windmill blade exploded. It was like, it was Russia.
On the other hand, just while we're here, I don't want to segue into anything else right now, but I do want to mention that anyone can go and look this up. The area surrounding Chernobyl, since the Chernobyl meltdown, the biodiversity in the area, yes, it took a knock initially. There was a big, there was lots of warping of genetics in the area because of the radioactive fallout. But in the years since then, they've sent in drones, they've sent in people to go and take a look. There's been numerous studies done. And what they found is that because humans are no longer allowed into the area, the biodiversity surrounding Chernobyl has skyrocketed. It is one of the most biodiverse areas in the world.
See.
And this is something to consider, is that potentially we want to build nuclear stations, and we might not want to build them all that well. We want to take that risk that they're going to melt down, force human beings to exit that area for an extended period of time so that the natural world can once again reassert itself and establish new forms of balance and biodiversity.
Yeah, look, I mean, we always in our culture paint nuclear disasters as like the worst thing that could possibly happen. But the worst thing that could possibly happen is exactly what's happening now, which is we stay in these giant, like, concrete behemoths using nothing but fossil fuels and killing everything on the planet and then making it completely inhabitable for any life, maybe bacteria, and then we just burn ourselves out. But if we just build nuclear reactors and then just don't even decommission them, then everything will return to, like, the most pristine, wonderful wildlife that you can imagine. I think it's a good
exactly.
idea.
Exactly. I dig it. I dig it. It's the way I see dystopia and an actual utopia, never mind dystopia.
If, I mean, everyone talks about this lesser of two evils saying, like, when elections are around. How about the lesser of two evil apocalypses?
Hells yeah, I'm totally for the nature takes over again.
Yeah, I want the nice apocalypse, not the bad one. Alright, so okay. the last point is that renewables are overwhelmingly supported by the public, so nuclear actually has quite a bit of opposition. You know, it's not even just like a lefty thing, it's kind of I don't feel safe being around a nuclear power plant type of thing. But yeah. Everyone, like, when they've done any polls that are, like, properly done, I guess, almost everyone supports renewables. The people that are against it are, like, a small vocal minority or, like, paid trolls or some shit. If we're going to talk about storage, we should also talk about load control, because they're really, really closely connected. I mean, energy storage is basically a type of load control, and what that means is just the balance between the production of energy and the consumption of energy. And that can include what type of energy is being demanded, because when we think of energy, we only think of electricity, but obviously people use heat as well to heat their houses and their water for industrial processes. And, you know, there's other forms like mechanical and stuff like that, but the main two, oh, and there's cooling. So the main three are heating, cooling, and electricity. Those are the three main consumption types. So right now what we use mainly for load control is what's called a peaker plant. And it's basically usually fossil-fueled plant where the turbine, instead of being designed for the maximum efficiency, it's designed to be flexible so that when peak demand happens, which is, I think, between like 4 and 7 p.m., they get turned on to compensate for the demand that the baseload power plant can't provide.
Okay.
So the goal with renewables, obviously, is to replace those peaker plants with something else. You know, maybe even a renewable peaker plant, if such a thing could exist. And to essentially control the generation and consumption of energy so that the supply meets the demand.
So I've just got a quick note here on peaker plants. Looking at global trends, looking at research, looking at the way things are heading, I've come across what I think are four let's call them signs that peaker plants are heading toward obsolescence.
Okay.
The first is the fact that solar energy generation and energy storage are Yes, they've always traditionally been linked in that your solar panel is connected to your battery and you have to store up your energy. But as energy storage has progressed and the new technologies are taking over and the new solar plants are incorporating proper energy storage that allows them to run for 24 hours and you know, unbroken, as that's happening more and more, the need for peaker plants are disappearing. Mm-hmm. Then we look at the fact that the cost-benefit arguments for peaking plants, they're slowly but surely they're losing ground. You know, for years, the primary argument in favor of peakers over more sustainable alternatives was the price difference. But as the prices come down for sustainable alternatives, obviously these peaker plants become less and less desirable mm-hmm. from an economic standpoint, even if you are a wealthy capitalist that... relies on the existing fossil fuel based grid.
Okay.
Good then to know. There's over the last 10, 15, and I suppose you could even say the last 20 years, the awareness surrounding environmental concerns regarding the existing energy systems has really been gaining ground. Yes, there are politicians that stand in the way. Yes, there are big energy companies like Exxon and BP and some of the other big
the
ones.
The biggest companies in the world.
Yeah, that are standing in the way of progress being made. But at the end of the day, you can't sell what people don't want. They can produce all their oil and their fossil fuels, and they can put it all into electricity that they feed through grids. If people... because of environmental concerns, reject the product, then they've put all that investment in for nothing, they're not getting anything back, and they have to scale back. And to me, that's a good thing. As they scale back, new peaker plants won't be built. I know that right now, in California, there are... I've chatted to several activists who are going out of their way and working really hard to prevent the development of new peaker plant in Oxnard.
Okay.
Yeah. So and from what I've heard, they are gaining ground, and they're not alone. There are these kind of protest activism things happening pretty much anywhere that new peaker plants are trying to go up. Communities are no longer accepting this unacceptable and unsustainable way of dealing with energy.
See, protest and works, y'all.
But yeah, it really does, man. And not when you're protesting knocking down a statue. It's stupid. Anyway, consumers of energy, which is technically all of us, people around the world are starting to adopt more energy conservative strategies. Mm-hmm. We're learning how to conserve energy. We're learning to switch off that water heater when it's not in use, to not leave lights burning all night long, to use energy sparingly and efficiently and when it's needed. As we're employing energy-saving light bulbs. People are becoming more and more aware. And as these four basic trends converge, the need for peaker plants goes out the window. And yeah, those are my notes on peaker plants.
Cool. So the main replacement that pretty much everyone knows about for peaker plants to store solar and wind energy and to make up for the part of the demand which can't be completely fulfilled by the power plants themselves, everyone knows about batteries. So there's two...
Yeah. Batteries!
Yeah. There's two, like, really overwhelmingly used technologies for this purpose. I mean, like, in the U.S., 80% or so of batteries are alkaline, which means they're non-rechargeable. But in terms of rechargeable batteries, the kings are lead-acid batteries, which are, like, one of the oldest technologies. It's still the most balanced form of storage, as in, like, it's really cheap, It's good density and power, good lifespan, safe and readily available. They do require a little bit of maintenance depending on the cell type. Some of them you have to top off with water every now and again. But other than that, you know, they're very reliable. The main problem with them is if you want to use them for like an off-grid thing, you have to have like a battery room. You have to have like a whole part of your house dedicated to putting a ton of batteries in there.
That's what I had.
Okay. and so the other one everyone knows is lithium ion. That's the media darling. It's got the highest density of commercially available rechargeable batteries, and it's still improving, both in terms of the storage density and how cheap it is, how easy it is to get them, and the lifespan, so the number of cycles that it can be charged and discharged. They do have a bit of a safety issue. You know, it's been largely solved through electronics, but of course, you know, there was the whole Galaxy Note scandal pretty recently where they were exploding.
Oh, you're taking your Samsung on the airplane? I too like to live dangerously.
Man, like, they issued a mandatory recall, like, if you own this phone, you have to bring it back to the store by today. And I was in this bar near me, Fast Eddie's, like a week after that happened. And there was a girl that was in there, and she's like, "Do you have a charger?" And they're like, "Oh, what do you need one for?" And she's like, "Galaxy Note 7." And everyone, like, kind of scooted away from her.
Everyone, run! She has a bomb! Yeah, no, that one cost Samsung quite a bit, yeah.
Okay, so the next type, because, you know, lead acid and lithium ion, you can go read about it on Wikipedia. There's plenty of information there. Not super interesting.
We're not here to talk about normal stuff. We're here to talk about unusual stuff.
Exactly. So the next battery type I wanted to bring up was zinc air, which is like...
Wait, what?
Zinc air.
Nice.
Yeah.
I like
it. So it's not currently rechargeable. There's research into making it rechargeable, but it has overwhelmingly the highest storage density. I think the highest density lithium batteries are 250 watt hours per kilogram. If I'm getting that unit right, I can't remember. And zinc air are like 500 plus watt hours per kilogram. They're used in like hearing aid batteries. And the reason for this is because part of the material that the battery uses to generate electricity, I don't want to say which part because I'm going to get it wrong, is air. So it doesn't have to be stored in the battery. It just kind of has like an open cell. And so it like uses air as it's operating, and so most of it, so most of the material is just the zinc part, and yeah, they're used in like hearing aids and other places where you need like a really small dense battery. But there's not like a whole lot of research into the rechargeable thing, so I wouldn't call it like a viable thing for grid storage. The one that I really wanted to talk about, though, was vanadium redox batteries, which, first of all, like, that name is cool as hell. I think it has the coolest name of any battery technology. Vanadium redox. That's awesome.
It really is.
So the thing about it, it's a flow battery, and so basically the energy is stored as a flow of like liquid electrolytes, and so they're extremely safe. There's like no real danger to it. The electrolyte is very safe. It's like acidic, but that's about it. It's not like lithium batteries where it can catch on fire. They're extremely long lasting, so they last over 100,000 cycles. Which compared to a lithium, most lithium batteries are like 500 cycles. So that's like a 30-year lifespan on the battery. So you could use the same battery and solar panels for like the same amount of time.
Damn.
And because the the battery is just like tanks of liquid, it can be scaled almost indefinitely. So you just need like a bigger tank of liquid to have more capacity. And it can be left completely discharged. So if you leave a like a lead acid or a lithium battery completely discharged, it's going to cause damage to it, and it's not it's going to either not work as well, or it's going to have an increased likelihood of doing something crazy like catching on fire and exploding.
Yay!
Yeah, so keep your phones charged, because that's really
if
bad
you
for your battery.
Charge your phone, if you don't charge your phone, you will kill someone.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard, you know, it's pretty uncommon now, but I've heard people, like, as recently as a year ago, saying, like, thinking that what you have to do with nickel metal hydride batteries, which is discharge them all the way, like, applies to all batteries. Because I was like, oh man, your phone's at like 2%, you should charge that thing. And they're like, oh, but isn't it like bad to not discharge your phone battery all the way? And I was like,
no, people don't
no.
understand lithium batteries at all.
Yeah.
I remember I heard someone say it in a bar sometime a few years ago, and I got home and I just immediately I had to research it, and I found out very easily and very quickly, thank you Google, that lithium batteries love being charged.
Yeah.
When you're not using it, put it on charge. That's like the standard rule. They love being at full capacity because it helps the ions flow properly.
Yeah. And if you're going to store lithium batteries, I know this because I was building a battery a couple years ago and looked this up on like a bunch of different websites. If you're going to store a lithium battery, charge it to about 40% and then put it in a plastic bag and put it in the freezer, and it'll last a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
I suppose that the reduction in temperature keeps the
yeah, it slows down the reaction.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
I suppose it makes sense.
So anyway, yeah, these cool ass vanadium redox batteries.
They sound too good to be true. Are there any drawbacks?
Oh, the drawback is their density is kind of low.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think it's lower than lead-acid batteries.
So you'd actually need quite a substantial thing just to run a home for
you. Yeah, and they're also very heavy, and, you know, since they're full of liquid, they probably, like, if you tried to move them around, the center of gravity would probably shift a bit. So they're mainly used for grid storage. They're not really practical for vehicles at all.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's great for grid storage because they're maintenance free, basically. At least,
yeah, no.
I don't think they require any maintenance. Nothing said anything about that.
I think that they would work very nicely in a VIAC type system.
Yeah. Yeah, they could. Oh. I mean, they're basically about the size. I think they're about the size of a shipping container for grid storage applications. And so there's this power station in Nishi Sendai, or it's called Nishi Sendai Substation. It's in Nishi Prefecture, Japan. And it has a 60 megawatt hour vanadium redox battery array. And it's, from the looks of the pictures that I saw, it looks like a bunch of shipping container sized batteries just kind of all lined up in, you know, a big grid, and it feeds into this power station. So it seems like it's kind of modular the way that you would set them up, you know.
That's really cool, man.
Yeah. There's also some substations in Escondido, California, and Pullman, Washington, that both have 4 and 2 megawatt vanadium redox batteries.
So nothing on the same scale as Nishi.
No, that's the biggest one by far.
Fair enough.
It's pretty. Well, I think it's pretty cool looking too. Like if you Google Nishi Sendai, it looks pretty rad. I think not as cool as the panda thing, but you know, it's pretty cool. So yeah, those are the main battery technologies.
Oh yeah, no, those are cool.
Yeah,
those are very cool.
Yeah, yeah, they're awesome.
Nice.
So
but it's not pretty. Yes, it is.
It's brutalist architecture.
Nice.
So this is kind of batteries, not really. but it's basically on the topic. There's also this thing for storage and I guess load leveling. Anyway, it's called grid integrated electric vehicles. Most of the articles I found were called vehicle to grid, but that mainly refers to electric cars charging when electricity is cheap in order to like sell it the electricity back to the grid, which just seems stupid. It's basically like they even called it carbitrage. It's just like arbitrage of electricity using electric vehicles. But the main criticisms in that article were like, you're going to reduce the efficiency of your battery by cycling it more than it needs to, which I was like, yeah, but that's not even what I was looking for. So like, I read this article, I think I actually have it in my file drawer, called like developing grid infrastructure with renewable resources that operate 99.9% of the time or something like that. And it's basically some simulations for different mixes of renewable generators, batteries. I think they had like centralized heat, like combined heat and power type situation where your heat doesn't come from like a furnace in your house. It comes from a power plant nearby you and it's just piped in. Like they had that in New York City. There is like Edison power. They generate steam and they pipe it through these pipes, and it's been there for like 100 years. You know those pictures you see of New York where there's like steam coming out of the street? That's what that's from.
Yeah,
it's from centralized heating, which I didn't know until I started looking into this stuff.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the technologies they covered in the article was grid integrated EVs, and you know I didn't look into it much at the time, but like the idea of it was, we need to charge electric vehicles anyway, so we may as well consider them part of the storage equation, where like you know excess energy has got to be dumped somewhere. It may as well be dumped into something that we're already going to be using, which is transportation, and so that can be considered part of the storage equation. It wasn't this weird selling electricity back to the grid from your car thing.
No, look, this sounds a little bit more rational.
and I think the best way to do it, I don't know if anyone saw, we've already talked about Elon Musk a bunch of times during this episode, but he did a presentation which was actually pretty cool, which was a Tesla battery swapping station where it swaps out the batteries in a Tesla car in like 90 seconds or something like that.
Same time you would fill up gas with.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've always thought that would be a great idea. Like, I had no way to do anything about it, but I was like, man, they should just make them batteries so you can swap them out and not have to wait for it to charge. And so I think if we combine the two ideas, I think that could be a really good solution for renewable load control and storage, where you could have these stations that have generators on site that have battery swapping stations there. And so the renewables just charge the batteries that they have that people swap out, and then, you know, you come up in your car and pick up a new one.
Honestly, I think we can take that one step further and look at the MIT city car system.
Uh-huh. Oh, and do it automated?
City car system? Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be automated, but yeah.
Is this like a car share?
Instead of... Yeah, it's okay. A massive car share program that covers an entire municipality. You don't. Studies have found that people use their car for an average of 40 minutes in a day. That's out of 24 hours. One person is using that vehicle for 20 minutes. If you plan it properly, then you need about 60 or 70% less. No, sorry, 30 or 40% less vehicles in a metropolitan area in order to sort out that entire transport system. If you step away from the I own a car paradigm to this community owns this group of vehicles that are stationed at strategic locations where obviously they are then being charged via renewables, it's then a simple case of get an app on your phone, order a car, it self-drives to your location from the nearest node on your network, and from there you move around. The vehicle doesn't belong to you, it belongs to the community, but you are a part of the community. It's a much more efficient system, and I think that works quite nicely with the EVS system that you're talking about.
Okay, so rebuttal. All right. First of all, you should let your money work for you. So instead of paying rent to some, you know, highfalutin college boys to, you know, drive a car for like 10 minutes, buy a car, and then you can sell the electricity that it stores back to the grid. So it's an investment, okay? Second of all, freedom.
Freedom!
Third, you know, when people own property, they take better care of it. That's why there's no, like, beaten up cars on the road or, like, people that smoke in their car, because it's their property, so they care about it. They want to be able to resell it later, and you just can't do that with this system. So, sorry, I gotta say it's a bad idea.
Terrible, right? This is, in all honesty, when you do a rebuttal like that, it reminds me exactly of why I stopped debating politics with conservatives.
All right, look, they have some good points once in a while. Sometimes. But usually it's just funny to listen to.
Indeed. Okay, so now we've spoken about the really cool version of EBS.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to get into one of the topics you looked into? I've been talking the whole time.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about ammonia-based energy storage.
Yeah, I'm excited for this. I want to hear about this.
Yeah, this is something that I actually came across trying to find that original article. Basically, someone went back in 2015 in South Africa. Because there's a lot of different kinds of renewable energy up and coming in South Africa, there's a lot of research surrounding the various technologies. And what these people went and did is they found that they needed to look at the different storage techniques surrounding solar plants and what is the most efficient. And what they found was that the best way for it to run is a three-pronged attack, with one being direct energy storage, like your steam systems, your thermal storage, like so you've got your water heaters and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Okay. Then for your short-term storage to use, it's got different names, from thermocline storage to I can't remember all the different names, but essentially it's rock bed thermal storage,
which is really cool. Just using cool. Rocks.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a second.
Okay.
But then for your long-term storage, because you need a mix. You need direct, you need short-term, and you need long-term, so that everything can be balanced out quite nicely.
And that's for, like, seasonal variations in demand, right?
Yeah, and it covers, basically, you can cover all year round by having these three different systems working in combination with each other. Mm-hmm. And so ammonia-based energy storage is basically where they take liquid ammonia and they store it in it's a chemical reactor, and as the liquid ammonia absorbs thermal energy, it actually has one of the best energy storage densities that you can by volume and mass that can be found.
Okay.
So pretty similar to that other one that you mentioned earlier. it's a ridiculously high energy storage, and like I'm looking it up, but I can't find the exact figures now, and I don't want to waste time.
Yeah.
So it stores it up, and at a later time, the byproducts of hydrogen and nitrogen are reacted on demand in an energy releasing reactor,
mm-hmm.
so that they resynthesize ammonia and recover the stored solar energy.
Okay.
So it's basically a chemical reactor
uh-huh.
that stores everything and then recombines the reactive gases so that you basically have this closed cycle of liquid ammonia that goes to hydrogen and nitrogen and then back to liquid ammonia and then back to hydrogen and nitrogen, and it's this perfect little cycle with very little energy loss in the cycle.
So it's kind of like a refrigerator.
Kind of, yeah.
A refrigerator that stores energy instead of food.
Indeed. And so apart from the ability of the ammonia system to allow for solar energy storage, there are other advantages that are not necessarily shared by other solar thermochemical or photochemical systems. These are, like I already mentioned, it's the high energy storage density. The reactions are easy to control and to reverse.
Okay.
And there are no unwanted side reactions, which is something that is actually pretty unique. You know, most of the time when you perform any kind of chemical reaction, there's other things that happen as well. That's actually the reason that
batteries degrade over time.
Yeah, exactly. So now you've got the system where there's no other reactions and your container stays a container. It doesn't eventually become a leaker. Okay. There does exist a history of industrial application with the associated available expertise in hardware. So it's not like this completely new technology that no one knows anything about or anything.
Right.
So it's actually pretty easy to roll out and install at various solar plants.
Mm-hmm.
You can take people from different fields and apply their knowledge to this. It's not like you need a very highly specialized nuclear scientist.
So more jobs.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's got a relatively achievable turning temperature of around 400 to 500 degrees centigrade. I don't ask me to do the Fahrenheit conversion. I don't know how you Americans deal with Fahrenheit.
Yeah, y'all can just do it in Google.
So obviously that depends on the pressure. And because of this, it helps to reduce the thermal losses that are experienced from dish receivers. So it avoids some of the high temperature material limitations, and it allows a lower quality dish optics to be used.
Interesting.
Which is big, because it means you can reduce the cost of a solar plant.
Uh-huh.
Also, at ambient temperature, the ammonia component of reactant mixtures, it condenses to form a liquid, while the nitrogen and hydrogen remains as a gas. So only one storage vessel is required for reactants and products. You don't need like a dozen different tanks and so on and so forth.
They just separate on their own.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah, then also ammonia resynthesizes ammonia resynthesis could occur at a site some distance away, like you could do it a mile away, 5 miles away from the solar plant. And by transporting the ammonia, the nitrogen and the hydrogen in high pressure pipelines to and from the plant, this actually isn't that big a deal. In this configuration, the pipelines would be forming part of the storage volume.
I think I remember reading, I think I looked up something about ammonia storage. I didn't get to look much into it because I was looking at other stuff, but I think I remember it saying the pipelines only have to have a pressure that's like slightly higher than a bicycle tire.
Exactly.
It's not like an oil pipeline that's like extremely highly pressurized and like dangerous.
Yeah, so you literally have the system where it's actually a good thing to not have the stuff stored right on site.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously solar power plants do have a tendency to reach relatively high temperatures,
mm-hmm.
and so there's temperature regulation issues that you can bypass by putting the ammonia storage facility a distance away, and then having all that piping act as extra storage in the entire system. So ammonia storage has a real huge amount of benefits, other than just, hey, look, we can store some energy.
Right on. Is that all you had for it?
That's what I've got for ammonia energy storage. I basically just wanted to explain it and explain some of the pros.
Okay.
I'm not too clued up on all of the cons.
Right.
The research that I was looking into didn't really bring them up. I can go and look for more, but at this stage, I'm too excited and I don't want to be a downer.
All right, so next up is geological storage. So there's several different types. This is actually one of the most viable, like, large-scale grid storage options. So I'll first talk about compressed air storage because it's not as practical. Basically, the idea is you use excess energy that you want to store to pressurize air in a tank. And so you use a compressor for that. And then when you need to withdraw it, you use what's called an expander, which is basically just something that uses the air pressure to generate energy, either heat or electricity. And so it's just like a big air tank that you use to store mechanical and heat energy. But the reason it's not as viable is because of the way gases work. As it gets discharged, the pressure gets lower over time, and so like it's not producing the same power output the whole time.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna have an energy storage,
I would actually imagine there's a fair amount of energy loss there.
There's a decent amount of loss. The main source of loss actually comes from, again, from the properties of gas. If you pressurize a gas, then it's gonna heat up, and so you need to either dissipate that heat, or you need to capture and use it somehow. And so the less advanced method is to just dissipate the heat, which I think lowers the efficiency of storage down to like 30-40%.
Wow.
And that's what's called adiabatic storage, or isothermal storage, I think, is also that sort of process. There's also adiabatic storage, which is where you preserve the heat and then you somehow use that either as a heat source or to generate electricity. So you know, most storage methods, they have a pretty consistent power output when you withdraw from them, but compressed air storage doesn't. And the advantage of the low cost of using compressed air storage is kind of counteracted by the need to use some other more advanced system to keep a constant power output.
Okay.
So the next one is kind of a category because there's several different subtypes of this, is pumped hydro energy storage. There's actually one of the largest pumped hydro energy storage facilities in Central Virginia. So the basic concept is that you have these two either reservoirs or, you know, like basically some water source, and one is elevated much higher than the other. And so what you do is you take the excess electricity that you're generating and you use it to pump water into the higher reservoir, and then when you need to use the electricity, you let it flow into the lower reservoir, and you basically reverse the pump into a turbine.
Yeah. This is, I mentioned it earlier on when we were talking about the early plans when South Africa first dropped apartheid, and what one of the plans that was put forward was to have the coastal areas pump water inland to the higher lying areas,
right,
and then
right, yeah.
Just let it flow back down and run turbines when you need energy again. So it would have been an energy storage system, but that never happened.
Okay. So with compressed air storage, it actually uses two different devices. It has a compressor and an expander. But with pumped hydro storage, it actually uses literally a reversible turbine. And I think reversible turbines were invented in the 40s, and they fairly quickly realized that this was a thing that was possible to do. So that it's a pretty old concept, pumped hydro. The advantages are it can store huge amounts of electricity at low cost. It can have an ecological disruption effect, especially if you use a dam as you know, to create one of the reservoirs. I think most of the problems associated with dams, other than the hazards of to fish that are trying to swim down the river, I think most of it is caused by all reservoirs, because there was a study about this recently where it went through the news outlets pretty quickly, but it was about how the study found that hydro plants can actually cause problems. Well, if you read the study, it actually said any reservoir. It doesn't have to be a hydroelectric plant. Any reservoir that's improperly designed can cause ecological problems, and so the reverse of that, of course, is that if they're properly designed, then they can not cause those problems. So cheap, huge amounts of storage, pretty ecologically benign if it's done correctly. The disadvantages are, of course, that it can be ecologically harmful, but also that it requires pretty high capital costs. There's a limited number of sites for traditional pumped hydro storage. The average head height, as in the difference between the higher and lower reservoir, is 400 meters, and there's not a whole lot of places where there's two reservoirs that are 400 meters apart in height that are relatively close to each other. So
here in Bahrain, we've got the highest point on the island is it's 150 meters above sea level.
So pretty flat.
It's a very flat island. In fact, the highest point on the actual island in physical terms, in non-natural terms, is one of the skyscraper buildings that have recently gone up.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So there's a couple of subtypes, or I guess alternative types, that have been devised to overcome the limitations of traditional pumped hydro storage. And so first I'll talk about underground pumped hydro storage. Basically, it's a pretty obvious change. Instead of having a higher and lower reservoir, you just have a higher reservoir and an underground either reservoir or tank or something. And there's proposals for doing this using reclaimed mines. So because the mines essentially
have already dug
giant,
down,
the giant water tank, then they can be used for pumped hydro storage.
Okay.
My boss is messaging me. Shit.
People tell me multiple times a day, every day, that I'm the most important person in human history, that I'm a genius, and the greatest hope for our species' survival. The thing that those nasty dirt people who worship the ground I walk on get wrong is that I'm also very humble, and I care more about helping others than any other extremely wealthy genius hero. That's the reason I created the Tesla Powerwall. For only $3,500, plus another $4,000 for an inverter and installation, you can power your whole home for 3 hours up to 500 times. This changes everything. No longer will you be enslaved to big oil for your electricity. Now, you only have to depend on them from midnight to 9 p.m. And this isn't just for American peasants. In remote villages in places like Africa, China, and whatever other countries are out there, there are large potential markets where there's no access to the grid. Now, even the poorest sorghum farmers of Africa or trash miners of India can spend $7,500 plus another $5,000 for solar panels to get solar electricity for their mud hut. I see a beautiful future, one where even the lowliest pay toilet attendant can give me, Elon Musk, $12,500 plus another $50,000 for a Tesla vehicle to have access to the same type of things that I do, except fewer, and obviously not as good.
Okay.
Yeah, she actually does that a lot. Like, whenever I have a day off, if I happen to be at my computer, she'll IM me and be like, Ryan, do you have a minute? And I'm like, yes. I'm not doing anything important right now.
Gee, thanks, Ryan. Thanks.
Okay, so yeah, we were talking about underground pumped hydro storage. So I wanted to just touch on, there's a project called the Elmhurst Quarry Pumped Hydro Storage Project. It's a conceptual project as of the time the article was written that I read. And it would use an abandoned mine and quarry for the upper and lower reservoir. So the quarry's done being used, so it's going to be the upper reservoir, and then there's a mine nearby that they can use to lower the water into. And so this is in Elmhurst, Illinois, and it's within 20 miles of Chicago. So it says it appears to be an attractive project due to its flood control capabilities, renewable generation opportunities, and potentially low environmental impacts, and its proximity to electrical transmission and a large load center, as in Chicago. So that, nice. That, I think that's pretty cool.
That actually sounds very promising.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bunch of quarries around here that I'm sure that once they're done using them, they could be used for, reservoirs, for pumped storage. Nice. So the next type is pretty similar. I mainly read about it in someone's thesis. So it was mainly like a simulation type thing, not like an actual project that was being proposed, but it's called aquifer underwater pumped or underground pumped hydro storage, also known as surface reservoir pumped hydro storage. So it uses existing high flow water wells that are already used for agricultural water, and so the idea is basically to combine pumped hydro storage with agricultural water use, so you can actually like withdraw the water and use it to water your crops, but it's also used as sort of a battery.
Because once you've watered everything, the water drains back down into the aquifer.
Exactly. Yep. And so most of the paper was just like analyzing the like technical problems of like how fast the water can flow into the ground and different types of doing it, but basically the conclusion was that it could be cost competitive with lead acid batteries, because even though like the total equipment costs are pretty expensive, most of them are already needed for agricultural irrigation, so the cost can actually be competitive with regular batteries.
Okay.
And so the last type is underwater pumped hydro storage. I think this is the coolest one. Instead of having an actual reservoir, they just put a sphere that's submerged deep underwater. And so instead of using like potential energy where, you know, the water is higher or lower as the storage medium, underwater pumped hydro storage uses the pressure variation between shallow water and deep water.
Okay.
And so because it's just a sphere, it's actually very low cost. The only really mechanical part that you need to connect to the like the load source is the cable to transmit electricity. So everything else is just in the sphere. And so It's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Much more viable. Like, there's a lot more locations for it than you know, any of the other options. And what else? The cost is very low. And yeah.
Yeah, and also, like, because there's no mechanical working parts, you're looking at very little energy loss.
Yeah, sorry, I should say that the mechanical parts, there obviously is a turbine. There has to be some sort of way to generate the electricity. But as far as parts connected to the land, the only thing is that cable, which is, it functions as both a tether and an electrical line.
No, it's just a lot of the research I've been doing, they look at the what is generally considered negligible energy loss due to mechanical things that are not directly related to the energy generation. So people assume that the friction on the turbine is your main energy loss, but it actually turns out that the more complex you make your energy generation, the more moving parts there are, the more friction. It's not just the turbine. What is considered negligible actually turns out to be quite substantial.
Okay.
In a lot of energy generation systems. So yeah, that's kind of what I was looking at. Obviously, there will still be some loss, but any way that you can minimize that, and energy loves to escape. Entropy is just one of those things. So any way that you can use to minimize that kind of energy loss is a big one.
So to compare this technology with traditional pump storage, traditional pump storage capable of storing 20 megawatt hours in a reservoir would need a hydraulic head of 519 meters. And remember, the average is 400. So that's well above average. And it requires a huge pressurized water pipe that requires like a hill or a mountain for physical support. And so the same system for underwater pumped hydro storage would be a 30-meter sphere, which is pretty reasonable to me.
Yeah. That actually sounds very workable.
Yeah. And so there was another thing I read. The total potential for this form of storage worldwide is close to 900 gigawatt hours, which is a pretty good number.
That's a substantial number. It's a little bit useful.
Yeah, so that's all I have for geological storage.
So I'm just doing a very quick search here because I want to see what global energy consumption levels are at the moment.
Man, I panicked for a second. The recording window like minimized itself to the taskbar, and I was like, "Oh shit, we have to do that all over again."
That would suck. In 2013, the International Energy Agency estimated that the total primary energy supply was 1.575 times 10 to the power 17 watt hours. That's 157.5 petawatts.
What kind of watts?
Petawatt hours.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's a fair amount of energy that we're busy generating across the planet right now.
Yeah. And I mean, we don't need to store that amount. We need to store the amount that we use above base load.
Yeah, definitely. But still, like, it's a bit shocking.
Yeah. So there's one last thing I wanted to cover on this topic, and this, I guess, is more towards load control than storage, but you could consider it storage. And a friend of mine actually worked on this. I was considering trying to interview him about it, but this episode is already so jam-packed, I don't think we would have time for it. So we can just touch on it briefly. It's using regular water heaters, like residential water heaters, with just about a $500 add-on, which pays for itself, by the way. So it's not really, you know, it's not really a cost for most people. So okay. It's using regular water heaters to store excess solar energy. So, you know, people obviously need hot water anyway. So they're going to be using either electricity or gas or whatever to heat up the water. And so if you do it when electricity is very cheap, as in when the supply of it is high compared to the demand for it, which is an area where supply and demand actually does determine the price.
Please ignore our last podcast.
Right. In that case, the water heater does actually act as a storage tank. And so this was started by the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. It's an American electric cooperative. It's rural. and so they found this actually is such a good way to offset peak load that it pays for itself almost immediately. And everyone has a water heater in their house. You know, not everyone has an electric water heater, but they're not extremely expensive. And so because they're so common, they're so plentiful, it could actually offset like a huge amount of peak load.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool option.
And at this stage, even if we weren't talking about a huge energy saving option here and a big storage, which we are, but even if it wasn't so big, every little bit that we can get into at this stage is necessary. You know, there's big changes that need to happen globally, and we can't get on with those if no one invests in the small changes that need to happen.
Yeah, I mean, if we can make as many small changes as possible that are effective, then, you know, we're that much closer.
Yeah. Now, this is how change happens. Every now and then there are big leaps, but for the most part, it's about the small changes that we make.
Yeah, I think everyone wants the renewable shift to be like this really, like, shiny,
drastic
high-tech
overnight
thing. Yeah. They want it to look like Ghost in the Shell, but instead it should look like Nausicaa.
I'm not sure we should be talking about Ghost in the Shell.
I mean, look, I do want a robot body. That's my plan. That's always my answer for any health hazard that I have for myself. Like, oh, are you gonna quit smoking cigarettes? Nope, gonna get a robot body.
Yeah, I'm gonna get me some robot lungs.
But I don't want everything to be like Ghost in the Shell. Some of it should be like Nausicaa.
I haven't watched that yet, so
you should watch it. It's a little bit basically social ecology. Pretty
cool. Really?
Yeah.
Please send me a link when we're done here.
Sure. Yeah. So we'll talk about that on another show, because I mean, obviously, we got to cover social ecology at some point. We're neighbor science.
Yeah, definitely. Neighbor sciences.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, folks, that's all we have for this episode. It was fortunately a little shorter than the first one. We have more to cover on energy in part 3, which will hopefully be coming out before the end of the month. And
greetings, friends and fans. It is I, Steve Jobs. Many of you may be wondering about my alleged death due to pancreatic cancer. As you can see, I am alive and well. It took a number of years for my body to regenerate, but thanks to visionary assistive technology, I am now back to my former self and now have an actual reason to park in handicapped spaces. I thank all who showed loyalty after my so-called death. As for those of you who lacked faith, who mocked me for using Eastern medicine to attempt to treat my illness, I have no more need for you or anyone else who doesn't follow me obediently. If you dare to cross me again, I will destroy you! As for how I will be moving forward, I have this to say. I regret leaving Apple. Tim Cook is an acceptable underling, but a fool of a leader. He has ruined the iPhone. Nobody wants a bigger screen. It's extremely uncomfortable to hold and too big to use one-handed. Now that I have returned to rule the technology industry, I can bring it into the 22nd century. I will be starting my own company and will center its commitment to social consciousness. The first step of this is to set the example for what capitalism can do for the world. As such, we will be employing only the most marginalized people, starving war orphans in Syria, who need jobs far more than those greedy Chinese Foxconn workers. This also means we will be supporting Assad and the Third World in their fight against the American Empire. I won't yet say what we will be making, lest I give the first mover advantage to a competitor. Suffice it to say, it will be securing a place for those on the right side of history. Go forth to your internet forums and YouTube videos and await my next announcement, which will revolutionize the human species.
So that's our 5-year plan for the podcast. Glad to share it with you. Hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next time.